What's that noise?
Just a fan.
Pardon?
A fan.
Okay. Gentlemen, we have a very special privilege. Why we assembled this room here, place the name of Kia Seder. We have a guest who's here from Eretz Yisrael. Actually, he's an American, but he's been there to solve for the last 50 years. He's a world class scientist, presently at Barilan University in Tel Aviv. And the author of three books so far on issues relating to physics, science, and Torah, as the screen says, on contradictions between the alleged contradictions as we see between Torah and science. So you may have heard of some of his books. There was a book called In the Beginning, a book called Fossils of Faith, and now a book called Modern Science and Ancient Faith. Considered one of the leading authorities of the world on the interface of Torah and science. And he's here, after a couple of our statements earlier, but we felt that if Professor Eliezer is here, we should not let him leave without making a presentation to some of our students. Many of you are or have taken advanced courses in science. Those who haven't may well do so next year. And most likely have been, if you're a thinking person, been at least curious about certain things that you may learn in science class that would seem to be at odds with something you may learn in your Torah class. I myself have had conversations. Type of question sometimes comes up and they ask the rabbi for it, so on. And so we're deeply honored to have this afternoon Professor Nathan Eliezer, as I said, is one of the world's leading authorities on these subjects. And having further delay, it's my pleasure to ask Professor Eliezer to share some words with us.
Good afternoon, everybody. Sooner or later, everybody asks the big questions. Where did the universe come from? Where did our planet come from? Where did life come from? Where did human beings come from? As is well known, these questions have answers in the first chapter of Sefer Bereishit, and I'm going to be speaking about that. And what does science have to say about these big times? Science had nothing to say. Science didn't know how to answer these questions. All that has changed in the last few decades. Now, for the first time in history, science also has answers to these large fundamental questions. And I'm going to be speaking about that too. So now that we have answers from the world of Torah and answers from the world of science, maybe it would be interesting to compare these two sets of answers. Well, you might say there's really no reason to expect any correspondence and harmony between these two sets of answers. The Torah speaks about the spiritual world, and science speaks about the physical world. The Torah was written thousands of years ago, and the scientists tell us what they discovered in the last few decades. And for other reasons also, there's no reason to expect any harmony and consistency between the world of the Torah and the words of the scientist. And my thesis is that this is completely wrong. Completely wrong. In fact, there is an amazing harmony and correspondence with the words of our Holy Torah written thousands of years ago and what scientists have discovered in the last few decades. I've even written a book. This is my third book on the subject. And I'm going to tell you some examples from my books to show you what I mean when I say that there is agreement and correspondence between Torah and science. So Now that we know what the program is, it's time to begin. The most exciting pasuk in the first chapter of Sefer Bereishit is the very first pasuk. Bereishit bara Elohim et ha-shamayim et ha-aretz. The beginning, God created the heaven and the earth. The term shamayim ha-aretz, heaven and earth, is used repeatedly in the Torah to mean the universe, the cosmos, everything. That is, the first pasuk tells us that the universe began through an act of creation. Presumably creation from nothing. For a long time, scientists thought creation from nothing, it's impossible, it's against the laws of science. But there's recently been a reassessment in cosmology. Cosmology is a branch of science that deals with the origin and development of the universe. And the modern theory of cosmology is called the Big Bang Theory. How many of you have heard of the expression Big Bang? Wonderful, you're famioed. The Big Bang Theory is supported by a vast array of scientific evidence. The Big Bang Theory is accepted by every cosmologist. This theory is taught in every university in the world. The Big Bang Theory was awarded the Nobel Prize in Physics. And the central theme of the Big Bang, the universe began through an act of creation. I repeat, the universe began through an act of creation. And it is interesting and instructive to quote some of the world's leading authorities on the subject of creation. We begin with Professor Paul Dirac. Paul Dirac is a Nobel Prize winner from the University of Cambridge and one of the towering giants of 20th century physics. Professor Dirac writes, "It is certain that there was a definite time of creation." Note that Professor Dirac does not write, "It is possible there was creation," "It is probable," "It is plausible that there was creation." No! In the eyes of this Nobel Prize winner, it is certain that the universe began through an act of creation. We now come to Professor Alan Guth, America's leading cosmologist. Professor Guth writes, "The instant of creation remains unexplained." We now turn to Professor Joseph Silk, another important cosmologist from the University of California. Professor Silk recently wrote a book on the Big Bang, entitled The Big Bang. He has no imagination in choosing titles for his book. The very first sentence of Professor Silk's book is, "The Big Bang is the scientific version of creation." And finally, we come to Professor Stephen Hawking, the cosmologist with a capital C, the superstar of the University of Cambridge. Professor Hawking writes, "The creation lies outside the scope of science. Today, every scientist speaks of the creation of the universe and uses the word creation to describe what happened. Because today, every scientist can obtain can take appropriate instrumentation, carry out appropriate measurements, and thereby obtain clear and unequivocal scientific proof that the universe was in fact created." The creation of the universe is no longer an article of faith. The creation of the universe is no longer some sort of theological hypothesis. The creation of the universe has become a scientifically established fact. Today it is impossible to have a meaningful discussion of cosmology without the creation of the universe playing a central role, just like the Torah tells us. And what do all these scientists mean when they say creation? Creation of what? What object was created to begin the universe? And it turns out the scientists have discovered that the universe began with the sudden appearance of an enormous ball of light. It's the primeval light ball, but it has a popular name, the Big Bang, and hence the name of the theory. And that answers another question. What do we read in the Torah? We read in the Torah on the first day of creation, "Vayomer Elohim yehi or, vayhi or," and God saw that there was light, and there was light on the first day of creation, when there is no sun and no stars and no fluorescent lights and no matches and no people and no source of light anybody ever heard of. And the Torah says, "And there was light." And for 3,000 years, nobody knew what these words meant. We were told that spiritual life may be light for the tzaddikim and the olam haba, but it can't be regular physical light, because on the first day, there was no physical light. And now the scientists tell us, yes, there was light. That's the way the universe began, by the sudden appearance of an enormous ball of light. Just like the Torah says, it takes the scientists, the goyish atheistic scientists, to teach us that the Torah means exactly what it says, kipshuto, and there was light. That's the way the universe began. Just like the Torah says. In other words, the Torah does not report on the first day of creation, two creations, the creation of the universe and the creation of the light. But the creation of the light was the creation of the universe, exactly like the Torah says. Now maybe a word about the time scale. How much time was required for all the cosmological events associated with creation? A cosmological event is an event which changes the structure of the entire universe. How much time was required? Millions of years? Tens of millions of years? Hundreds of millions of years? Well, the Torah speaks of one day, Yom Echad. What? Cosmological events within one single day? Why, that's absurd. Why, that's ridiculous. Why, that's scientifically impossible. Well, I have here a book. This book is written by Professor Steven Weinberg. Now, Steven Weinberg is a Nobel Prize winner, so we can imagine he probably knows what he's talking about. Incidentally, this is the best book of modern cosmology ever written, except for my books, of course. The title of his book is The First 3 Minutes. I repeat, The First 3 Minutes. It takes Professor Weinberg 151 pages to describe a long sentence which occurred in exactly 3 minutes. What? The Torah tells us the first day, a whole day, why there's enough time to create the universe, enjoy a hearty breakfast, and listen to an exciting lecture by Professor Nathan Aviezer. All the cosmological events associated with the creation of the universe took exactly 3 minutes. But how is that possible? How is it possible to change the structure of the universe within a few moments? And the answer is the temperature. Nowadays, the universe is very, very cold. Therefore, everything advances with enormous slowness. It takes enormous amounts of time for changes to occur. But at its origin, the universe was very, very hot. And therefore, events occurred one after another, chick-chack, with amazing rapidity. And when I say the universe was hot, I don't mean millions of degrees. I don't mean billions of degrees. I mean hot! And it was so hot that events which nowadays take millions of years, at that time occurred within minutes and fractions of minutes and even fractions of seconds. All the cosmological events associated with creation took exactly 3 minutes. Now, before I go on, I'd like to make a comment. So far, I've quoted half a dozen scientists. Some are Jewish, some are non-Jewish. The non-Jewish scientists that I've quoted never go to church. The Jewish scientists do not know what a shul is. As a matter of principle, I never, ever quote a religious scientist. Not in my lectures, not in my books. The scientist is religious. Maybe he twists things or distorts things to justify his religious beliefs. Every scientist that I quote is glatt treif, a complete atheist. So I know that this is the science. I love atheists. This is the science, and I take the science, and I take the Torah, and like a shatran, I look for a match between them. And my friends, the Shatranas business is doing very, very well. It is no longer the case that whenever the Torah says right, science says left, the Torah says up, science says down, the Torah says white, science says black. Nowadays, there's harmony and consistency between the words of the Torah and the words of the scientists. When all the scientists speak of the creation of the universe, and the Torah speaks of the creator of the universe, maybe they're speaking about the same thing. My message to you and to the 21st century is not required to choose between accepting the latest theories of science or being faithful to a Torah tradition of thousands of years old. Today you can have your cake and eat it too. It is a pleasure to be a believing Jew in the 21st century. Second day of creation. Second day speaks about the Shemayim, the Rakia, the heavens, what a scientist would call outer space. What do we read here? The functions of the heaven. By Avdel Ben Amayim Hashem Mitachat L'Rakia, Uven Amayim Hashem Me'al L'Rakia. And he separated between the waters below the heavens from the waters above the heavens. Waters below the heavens, I understand. Oceans, rivers, lakes, the Kinneret, water from the faucet, regular water. But Ribono Shel Olam, what possible meaning could be to the expression waters above the heavens? Has anyone ever heard of large bodies of water floating about in outer space? The idea sounds completely irrational. Therefore, my friends, I am happy to be able to announce that the scientists have discovered the waters above the heavens. At the edge of the solar system, there's enormous quantities of water. Ice, really, it's cold up there. Much more water than there is down here. What brought about that discovery? It was the space program. For thousands of years, we stood here and looked up at the sky without telescopes, with telescopes. We didn't really know what was going on up there. No longer. We now send satellites. They take pictures and bring them back. And for the first time in history, we know the structure of our solar system. And one of the great discoveries was the water above the heavens. There are really many sources of water. I'll concentrate on the main source. The main source of water is the comets. The comets. The theory of comets was established by Professor Fred Whipple, who refers to a comet as a dirty snowball. And the numerical data relating to the comets is guaranteed to stagger your imagination. A small comet, it's called a dirty snowball because a comet is essentially an enormous block of ice interspersed with interplanetary schmutz. A small comet contains 1 billion tons of ice. A large comet contains hundreds of billions of tons of ice. And how many comets are there up there? There's a vast reservoir called the Oort Reservoir after the guy who discovered it. And in the Oort Reservoir, there are hundreds of billions of comets, contains hundreds of billions of tons of ice. If it were possible to bring all this ice down to Earth and melt it, it would fill the ocean basins 1,000 times. The Mayim Me'al Rakia has become a scientific fact. Third day says the following. Yikavu ha-mayim mitachat ha-shamayim el makom echad v'teroeh ha-yabasha. Let the waters under the heavens be gathered into one spot and let the dry land appear. If we take these words literally, it's as if the Torah is telling us that the whole planet Earth was once covered with water, and then for some unknown reason there are vast oceanic flows, and all for a reason I have no idea why, and all the water goes to one place, I have no idea where this one place is, and the dry land appears. Something which sounds more like a mythological tale than anything that could be related to reality. Therefore, my friends, I am happy to be able to announce that the scientists have discovered that exactly that's what happened. Exactly that's what happened. In the distant past, the whole surface of the earth was covered with water except for the spitzen of the highest mountains, and that's the way it was for a long, long time. And then suddenly it began to get colder, and colder and colder and colder, and the most severe ice age which ever occurred struck this planet. And when it became sufficiently cold, large glaciers began to form around the South Pole. And these glaciers, enormous glaciers, locked up large quantities of water, and the ocean levels began to go down and down and down, and the dry land appeared. And all this is explained to us by Professor Niles Eldridge, world's expert on the subject. Professor Eldridge writes, 30% of the surface is land. Now we have 30% land, 70% water. But it was not always so. These are unusual times. To have continents at all is unusual times. It is much more usual to find the land covered with seawater. What is now the United States and Canada once lay beneath the waves. He's an American. He writes about the United States and Canada. All of Europe was on the water. Other Baruch Hashem was also on the water. He continues, as the earth cooled during the Permian Ice Age, large land areas appeared as the seas receded. What does the Torah gather in the dry land appeared almost word for word what the scientists tell us? Professor Eldridge writes, in the Permian Ice Age, the center of glaciation was the geographical South Pole. What does the Torah tell us? El Makom Echad, one place, the big picture. And the scientist tells us where this big picture was. It's the geographical South Pole. And what about the North Pole? There are lots of glaciers on the North Pole also, but there are about 20 times the volume of glaciers in the South Pole. It is much, much colder in the South Pole with regard to the North Pole. And why is that? What's the difference between the poles that makes the South Pole so much colder? And the answer is, what is underneath the ice in the South Pole? It's land, Antarctica. And what is underneath the ice on the North Pole? Water, the Arctic Ocean. Water is a large reservoir of heat. And because of the Arctic Ocean, it can never become so cold at the North Pole. There are glaciers there too, but the main source of the glaciers is the geographical South Pole, El Makom Echad. Now, the third day is interesting because it is the only day of creation where the Torah describes two separate events, the appearance of the dry land and the appearance of the plants. It says also on the third day, and so on. The plants also appear in the world. Why is it that these two separate events, the appearance of the land and the appearance of the plants, are associated with the same day of creation? What's happening? God is working overtime. What's the connection between these two events? And the answer is given by modern science. So let's look at an important Torah source, the Cambridge Encyclopedia of Geology, where we read, the colonization of the land by plants took place in the Permian period. That's the same period when the dry land appeared, the same period the plants appeared. In earlier times, the land surface was devoid of plant life. During the Permian period, lush green plants first spread over the landscape. The Torah says that the earth brings forth green plants, almost word for word from the encyclopedia. Since these two events occurred in the same geological period, the Torah associates them with the same day of creation. Fourth day. Not going to speak about the fourth day, can't do everything in a single lecture, so we will go on to the fifth day. The fifth day discusses the formation of the animal kingdom. Whenever we get to the animal kingdom, about evolution. What about Darwin's theory of evolution? What does the Torah have to say about Darwin's theory of evolution? And the answer is, the Torah does not deal with theories. The Torah deals with facts. And the Torah presents a factual description of the origin of the animal kingdom, a factual description which sounds completely impossible, even crazy. What does the Torah tell us? The Torah tells us, "Vayomer Elohim Yishlok Suamaim Sheretz Nefesh Chaya Suamaim Lemon," and God let the waters swarm with living creatures. the water swarm is all different types of living creatures. That is, the Torah tells us at the beginning of the animal kingdom, all the oceans and all the seas were suddenly filled with marine creatures in enormous numbers. Let the waters swarm, and all different types, and they appear. And the Torah does not speak about microscopic animals. The Torah speaks about large, modern, developed animals, and this happened all at once. Let the waters swarm. All the oceans and seas were filled, the Torah tells us, with marine creatures that occurred suddenly. Not only is the Torah description completely against Darwin's theory of evolution, not against evolution, against Darwin's theory of evolution, as is well known, Darwin's theory speaks about the gradual development of the animal kingdom. Nothing happens rapidly according to Darwin's theory. We start with primitive creatures, 1, 2, and 3 cells, and only in the course of millions and tens and hundreds of millions of years do these primitive creatures develop and evolve into large, modern, sophisticated animals. That took a long period of time. Nothing happened suddenly. So therefore, not only is the Torah description completely against Darwin's theory, it's against common sense. Who can believe something like this? Who can believe that suddenly all the oceans and all the seas became filled with marine creatures in enormous numbers and all various types, and it happened suddenly? Who can believe something like that? Therefore, my friends, I am happy to be able to announce that the scientists have discovered that exactly that's what happened. Exactly that's what happened. The fossil evidence is absolutely clear. Scientists have discovered to their utter amazement that at the beginning of the animal kingdom, all the oceans and all the seas were suddenly filled with marine creatures, enormous numbers of different types, and the scientists have given this a name. The scientists refer to this as the explosion of life forms. The explosion of life forms. And there's not a scientist who did not write about this with absolute astonishment. One scientist writes, a tremendous explosion of marine life occurred. Another scientist writes, the period ushered in an explosion of life forms. Yet another scientist writes, the most astonishing aspect is that so many radically different types of animals appeared within such a short interval. Yet another scientist, appearance of new phyla and classes of animals at a rate that has not been matched since. That's what the data show. And what is the scientific explanation for the explosion of life forms? Well, this was the subject of an article in the Scientific American. Scientific American is the most prestigious journal in the world for reporting scientific advances in all fields to the educated layman audience. And what's particularly important for the Scientific American, it's not some science writer who writes the article, but the scientist himself who writes the article. They emphasize with great pride that to date 139 Nobel Prize winners have written articles for the Scientific American. And this was the subject of an article in November 1992, and the scientist chose as his title the puzzling Big Bang of animal evolution. The term Big Bang is, of course, borrowed from cosmology. Only that term, the Big Bang, that the scientists find appropriate to describe the explosion of life forms. And the scientist writes, a remarkable burst of evolutionary creativity gave rise to all multicellular animals. And what is the explanation? Here we go. Why and how this occurred is one of the great mysteries of biology. One of the great mysteries of, well, to us it's not such a mystery, because that's what the Torah says and that's what happened. Well, this is 92, 20 years ago. Maybe something happened. In the meantime, I found another article, 2004, in another journal, New Scientist. title on the origin of phyla, play on words of Darwin, the origin of species, origin of phyla. And the scientist writes, the most important event in the history of life is still a mystery. Animals suddenly became abundant. The major groups of animals suddenly appeared. It is one of the most intractable episodes in our planet's long history. Let the waters swarm. Yishvatsu Amayim has become a scientific fact. You know, I give these lectures from time to time to different groups. And sometimes people tell me, yeah, I'm the other, science, science, science. I'm tired of hearing about science. Say something Jewish. So I'm going to end my lecture by saying something Jewish. And in the first chapter of Sefer Bereishit, there's an idea which stands behind this. The idea is that the universe is not a random, meaningless place. HaKadosh Baruch Hu created our universe for purpose. And the purpose of creation is not to make stars and planets and rocks. The purpose of creation was the living creatures, and not any living creatures. The purpose of creation was not crocodiles, kangaroos, and cockroaches. The purpose of creation is human beings. You and you and you, even the rabbis, they're the purpose of creation. God created the world for human beings. And that this is an idea which pervades all Torah literature. And a corollary of this idea is that HaKadosh Baruch Hu did not put anything in the universe which is not necessary for life on earth. Everything in the universe is needed for life on earth. Really? Everything in the universe is needed for life on earth? To be convinced of the absurdity of that claim, one is merely to think of the stars. Our sun is an ordinary, regular star. And stars appear in clusters called galaxies. And our galaxy is called the Milky Way, your family old. And how many stars are there in the Milky Way? There are hundreds of billions of stars in the Milky Way. And how many galaxies are there in the universe? This is one of the great discoveries of the 20th century. The vast size of the universe. There are billions of galaxies in the universe. With a typical galaxy containing hundreds of billions of stars, what possible connection could all these infinite number of stars that fill the cosmos, what connection between all these stars and life on Earth? The idea that the distant stars somehow influence life on Earth is astrology and superstition long abandoned by all educated people. So it was thought until recently. But recent discoveries have shown that I would not be exaggerating if I were to say that without all these stars that fill the cosmos, I, Natan Aviezer, could not exist to stand here and speak to you. Wouldn't matter. You couldn't exist to sit there and listen to me. So what is the connection between life on Earth and the distant stars? Well, I started this talk by telling you about the Big Bang theory of cosmology, which says the universe began with the sudden appearance of an enormous ball of light. So at the beginning, there was nothing but light. We are familiar today. Today, we're familiar with the universe, with stars and planets and rocks. Matter, the material. Where did all the material come from if we had nothing at the beginning but light? This is answered by Einstein's famous formula, E equals mc squared. Like the most famous formula in science, E is energy, M is mass. And Einstein's formula tells us that under appropriate circumstances, matter can be converted into energy. This is the source of nuclear energy. This is the source of the nuclear bombs which destroyed Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And this is the source of nuclear power stations for generating electricity. But Einstein's formula works both ways. Not only is it possible under appropriate circumstances to transform matter into energy, it is also possible under appropriate circumstances to transform energy into matter. And that's what happened. The initial ball of light was an enormous source of energy, and most of this energy was transformed into matter through Einstein's formula, and that's the source of all the matter, all the material we observe in the universe today. But life always has a but. Examination of the conditions of the Big Bang show that the energy to matter transformation, which occurred at the time of the Big Bang, will only produce the two simplest chemical elements. It'll produce hydrogen and helium, and that's all. The Big Bang doesn't produce anything else. But my body, we have carbon, nitrogen, oxygen, all the other chemical elements. Where did the other chemical elements come from? They did not come from the Big Bang. And this was a puzzle for many years until it was finally solved by Professor Fred Hoyle of the University of Cambridge, and he explained it came from the stars. The stars are chemical factories for producing complex elements. In the middle of the star, the temperature is so high and the pressure is so great that the simple elements, hydrogen and helium, are crushed together, crunched together to form the more complex elements, carbon, nitrogen, oxygen, and all the other elements in the periodic table. What good does it do me? What does it help me that the raw materials for my body are in the middle of a star? I can't live in the middle of a star. And then something amazing occurs. From time to time, an entire star explodes. This is called a supernova. Entire star explodes. It spritzes the chemicals into outer space, and they gather in certain places, and they condense to form planets, rocks, water, air, and the tissues of our body. And all that is explained in an important Torah source, the Cambridge Encyclopedia of Astronomy, where we read the following. It was once thought that the universe has always had the composition we observe today. But in fact, all the atoms on Earth, except hydrogen and helium, they came from the Big Bang. All the other elements were created inside a generation of stars formed before the birth of the sun. The elucidation of the process by which the chemical elements were formed stands in the history of science as one of the greatest advances of the 20th century. And this article ends with a sentence that I never believed that I would read in a scientific encyclopedia. It says, in truth, we are the children of the universe. We are the children of the universe. Like a child cannot exist physically without a father and a mother, you cannot physically have a child. We need the entire universe. It's necessary for our existence. We are the children of the universe. Exactly what our Torah tradition has been telling us for hundreds and thousands of years. Everything in the universe is necessary for our existence. And here we find it written in the encyclopedia. These words, we are the children of the universe, do not appear in the poetry of Yehuda Halevi. These words, we are the children of the universe, do not appear in the mystic writings of Rav Kook. These words, we are the children of the universe, appear in the Cambridge Encyclopedia of Astronomy. Torah and science have become one. Thank you very much. Yes, questions.
I will have a few minutes very quickly with some questions. I'm about to have people to continue to ask and say a little afterwards. I'll take a few questions.
Questions?
How long each of these last?
Pardon?
How long each of these last?
How long do each of these last?
Okay. You're asking a very fundamental question. The 6 days of creation versus the 4th. I have a principle. Good questions do not have short answers. It would be disrespectful to the question or the questioner to say a sentence or two chaplap to get rid of these questions. It would take me at least 20 minutes to give an important, a suitable answer to this important question. Can't do everything in a single lecture. I have a whole chapter in my book devoted totally to answering this question. If you know what the Rambam writes, and Moed Avruchim write down, part 2, chapter 25, what the Gemara says, in Sanhedrin, Sadizayin, and other Torah sources, we will see that there's no contradiction at all between the true Torah tradition and what the scientists tell us. In three words, not to worry, it's all okay, can't do everything in a single lecture. Good question, but it requires more time than I have now. Loudly, stand up and speak loudly.
When we got up to the evolution, you said that we don't really accept that because it's a theory of evolution. The Torah deals with theory. The Torah doesn't deal with theories. The Torah deals with facts.
Yeah.
Earlier, we talked about the Big Bang theory, we talked about the theory. And is it also
the word theory does not mean it's not correct. The term theory is just a description of what scientists say. Okay, the trouble with Darwin's theory of evolution is that it is not compatible with the fossil evidence. Not that it's called a theory. It's a theory of gravitation, a theory of the Big Bang. Of course, theory doesn't mean it's wrong. We call correct scientific concepts, we call them theories. What's wrong with Darwin's theory is based on gradual evolution. The fossil evidence, unfortunately for Darwin, does not support gradualism. And it's not Nathan Abiezer that says this. When I give a talk about evolution, I start by listing 20 world-famous scientists who tell us there's something wrong with Darwin's theory. Gradualism does not fit the facts. Stand up and speak into the microphone. Close to your mouth.
If what you're saying right now is shot and racist, then...
Turn around. Face them. Face them.
If what you're saying right now is shot and racist, then doesn't that mean that for thousands of years we didn't have proper shot of what racist is talking about, the Chazal manner of shot?
Yes, that's exactly what it means. You should understand, Chazal does not care about science. They're meddling us important concepts. They're not telling us what happened physically. My favorite example of this is Aesop's Fables. Famous throughout history, the fox and the grapes. Have you all heard of it? It's not talking about foxes, and it's not talking about grapes. It's talking about human behavior, and it uses the analogy of a fox as if a fox talked and liked grapes. That's the Midrash Chazal. They contain important Torah concepts. They are not telling you modern science. Not that Chazal was wrong. They were not talking about this subject. Or just speak loudly, scream. What's your name?
That.
A wonderful question. Did you hear what his question is?
Yes.
If plants occurred on the third day, how could the sun occur on the fourth day? Everybody knows that plants need the sun. Photosynthesis is how the plants survive. How could plants come before the sun? And the answer is that the sun occurred on the second day. And the fourth day is speaking about something totally different. You may have noticed I didn't mention the fourth day because it's technical. I can't explain technically. It's not suitable for this audience. In my book, I have a whole chapter on the fourth day. The sun appeared on the second day. The plants appeared on the third day after the sun. Can't have plants without a sun. And the fourth day discusses something totally different. If you read my book, get a copy, and you learn what it is. Great question.
I
can't hear.
I understand how we need all the materials that are created in the sun, so then why do we need billions of them?
Oh, one star isn't enough to give you all the raw materials to make our solar system. We need lots and lots of raw materials. And not every sun explodes. Every star explodes. You need a whole bunch, a certain fraction explodes. To get enough explosions, you need a lot of suns, a lot of stars. And that's what we have, and that's what happened. Okay.
Thank you very much.
Yes. In the beginning.
Which is another thing about the Rakia. It's on NASA's website. So, two teams of astronomers have discovered the largest and farthest reservoir of water ever detected in the universe. It's 140 trillion times all of the waters in the world's ocean. And it's 12 billion light years away.
So, yeah. You see? Lots of water up there.
Does science have anything to say about creation soup?
No.
No?
I speak about creation. I don't speak about creation soup, but I have something to say about creation soup. But I can't do it now, but I have something very much to say.
In your book?
Right? No, I don't speak about creation soup in my book. Thank you.
Israel. Which
pocket
are you in?
Do you share the song?